Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to episode 25 of the A24 project here on the Nerd Party, the only podcast to explore the back catalogue of A24 films, two films every fortnight. I'm your co-host Dallas King, and with me as always is Lee Hutchison. How are you this week?
Yeah, really good. Glad to be back together again.
Absolutely. Now, the last episode was a mammoth episode when we had Meg on to discuss Moonlight and American Honey. We'll just have to see if these two films this week inspire such a long, intense conversation. So on this week's episode, we're not looking back in anger as we shine a spotlight on 2016's Oasis documentary Supersonic and then take to the road for The Monster, starring Zoe Kazan. First of all, let us just say thank you to all of those who have left some lovely five-star reviews recently, such as FilmStan1993, who said A24 Project slays and A24 Project stan. Hidden Gem Movies and Podcasts said, just like most 20 A24 films, this podcast is a hidden gem. Awful Dreams said, a shout out, this is growing into the best resource for news, interviews, reviews, and discussion about A24. Essential listening. And this podcast is charting the filmography and history of A24 and getting the actors and directors involved really helps bring it all to life, said American Honey. So thank you for all the kind words. It really means a lot to us and it helps to raise the profile of the podcast. And if you would like to leave a review on iTunes, we will mention you on the show next time. And sort of just speaking about getting actors and directors involved on the podcast, Lee, you've been busy at work this week, and we've got another interview coming up, another bonus episode coming up. Do you want to give us a quick tease of that one?
Yeah, so we've got a couple that are going to be, we pretty much have enough interviews to be a weekly show all the way until the end of September. So as I mentioned in the last show, we have Danger Piece, the composer behind Under the Silver Lake, coming on. Patricia Rosema, she'll be on in a few weeks' time to discuss Into the Forest. And we've also recorded now an interview with Greg Sestero. So you might know him as Mark from The Room. He's also the writer of The Disaster Artist, which was adapted into the film adapted into a film starring James Franco. So he'll be on in the coming weeks. And we've also got another two lined up to record tomorrow and Monday night. And I don't want to jinx those ones, you know my feeling. Until they're recorded, I don't like to announce them in case I end up looking really stupid. So for those who want to hear our next interview, it's going to be with the composer behind It Follows and Under the Silver Lake. And here's a small preview of that interview.
Do you sort of score to film or create different themes for David to play with and use in the edit? What's sort of that relationship like for you two?
So for Silver Lake, we actually had an intention to write music ahead of time to have Julio, the editor, and David cut the movie to. But it ended up not being very practical. It requires a lot of writing that you wouldn't normally have to do. And a lot of that writing can go to waste because you're doing it in a preliminary fashion and there's no guarantee that it's less likely to hit the nail. It's less likely to hit the target because it's not, instead of reacting to the film being shaped, you're sort of like trying to help dictate it. So it ended up not really making sense for us. And so we kind of ended up going back to what we knew. Also part of that too is that I had taken a couple of cracks at sort of a direction for music before we ended up doing an orchestral score. Something that was a little bit more of a blend of orchestra and guitars and synthesizers and stuff like that. And it just wasn't really what David was hoping for. I think he wanted to incorporate more of a referential feeling to the score that, like the picture itself, is very much, you know, nodding towards other noir films. So we ended up going in a more traditional direction as far as like what we had done before, our approach.
So yeah, look out for that one next week.
Oh, I'm really looking forward to that one because It Follows was one of my favorite soundtracks of the last sort of 5, 10 years. I thought it was just fantastic, and I really liked his work on Under the Silver Lake. You know, one of our favorite films of the year, one of probably the most overlooked A24 films, but I think that's going to change over the next few years. So, really looking forward to listening to that in full next week.
Should be added, that's Quentin Tarantino's favorite film of the year so far.
Well, there you go. The high praise indeed, because that man watches a lot of films. So just like us, actually, he probably doesn't watch as many films as us, I would say, because he's busy making films. He probably doesn't have the time, because we do watch a lot of films, and that's because of our wonderful Cineworld Unlimited cards, which, you know, I'm just throwing that in because it just riles up American audiences who still don't have a system like that, and it just baffles me that they still don't. It's bizarre.
Absolutely.
Yeah, too many distributors, and it's just Disney just wanting to keep all the money. So we're heading into A24-hour news now, and I think the biggest news for us this week was the launch of the trailer and poster for Robert Eggers' follow-up to The Witch, or The Vitch, the VVITCH, or as now basically on the poster, they've just gone with a W, which caused a lot of controversy among A24 stands. So the Lighthouse trailer's come out. So this is the film starring Willem Dafoe and Robert Pattinson. And this was, I think, one of your most anticipated films of, I'll say, this year, but it could be for UK audiences 2020 before we get to see it. So what did you make of the first look at this film?
I'm so jazzed for this. Before we started recording this episode today, I picked up The Witch for 99 cents a few weeks ago as a rental on iTunes to sort of revisit it. And watching this trailer has me so excited. We've waited a long time for a follow-up film from Robert Eggers, and I've watched the trailer twice. The first time I watched it was on my computer at work, and then the second time was with my girlfriend, and I was blown away the first time. It wasn't the tone I expected. It wasn't even the look I expected. Everything sort of really surprised me about that trailer. And then I showed it to my girlfriend. I was like, "Oh, like, what do you think of this?" And then I think she did her best sort of impression of Jeff Goldblum from Jurassic Park and went, "That is one big pile of shit." So I wonder if this is going to be a film that might divide the general audiences, perhaps even more than something like Midsommar. For me, I'm completely on board with this, and I'm praying and hoping that it's going to get shown at the London Film Festival. So hopefully within the next 100 odd days or something like that, we will have seen this film. So that's what I'm putting all my hopes and energy into. What about for yourself? How did this one land for you?
I think, yeah, we'd seen, all I'd seen was like one still image of the film, which was the two of them standing outside Lighthouse. So I wasn't really sure what sort of tone and sort of the story that he was going for, but I think it looks just like a general gradual descent into madness of these two people alone on an island. I know we had a Scottish film recently this year called The Vanishing, which was about sort of three lighthouse keepers who go to work on a remote island lighthouse, and then they sort of find a body, and there's a mystery behind it. So I think it's just looking at the sort of isolation and cabin fever. I think someone compared it to the episode of The Simpsons where Mr. Burns and Homer get sort of stuck in a cabin in a snow lounge. But I think for Scottish fans, if anyone's ever seen Chewing the Fat, this is what it reminded me of initially, which is two lighthouse keepers where one of them is just trying to get through the day and the other one keeps playing pranks, and the other one's just like, "Oh, gonna no do that." And he's like, "How? Gonna no." And it's just, I can imagine it's, I don't know if it's going to be like Willem Dafoe basically being the cause of Robert Pattinson's descent into madness. He's just like teasing him and stuff like that. But I think we're going to get something that we're not expecting, and something really quite special. And you know, as I think many people know, Robert Pattinson is on a huge roll in terms of his A24 output. So anything with him in it, I think is going to be good. And yeah, to see a follow-up from The Witch to it, I think is going to be something very exciting. So yeah, all fingers crossed for a screening at London Film Festival. I think the full lineup will get announced at the end of August, so we're going to keep our fingers crossed till then. And I'm going to try and go down. I think you're going down for all of it. I'm going to go down for about half of it. So it's basically, I'm going to have to decide. Basically, if it does get a screening, that'll be the time I go down for. And because I don't think I really want to wait until around about March next year, which I think was the rumored potential date for a UK release. It's just going to be too long.
Yeah, and I how can you wait that long to find out what the hell an octopus is doing strangling Robert Pattinson?
Exactly, you know, it's maybe he was trying to recreate a scene of Old Boy. I don't know, maybe he tried to eat it and then the octopus fights back. So, other news this week, The Farewell is now heading out to a wide release in the US. It was on limited release to begin with, and it actually has the distinction of being one of the very few films to actually beat Avengers Endgame at the box office this year, and that was in terms of the biggest per theatre average, with an $87,833 per screen average on its opening weekend. Now, this film, I believe, is still rated around 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. It's a huge buzz come from it. Sean, who does Missing Frames, caught this film at the Atlanta Film Festival. It was over for the Sundance London here. It's coming out on the 23rd of September in the UK, so that's another one which I'm really looking forward to. Have you seen much about this one? Is this one that's on your radar?
I'm so excited for this. I love sort of family dramas, and I've avoided the trailers. Obviously, I've listened to the interview that we had with Lulu Wang about it, but I just want to see this film now. It's one of these ones that's sort of similar to Eighth Grade to an extent, without the sort of prolonged wait where there's so much good buzz, and what little I know about it, I know this is a film that's going to be sort of tailor-made for my taste, and I just want to see it. And I noticed in the A24 shop they've started selling this cute little dog, and I don't know the context of this cute little dog, so it's like probably people that are baffled why some people are obsessed or interested that the A24 shop are selling a bear toy. For me, I want to know the context behind this cute dog and why it's been made into toy form.
Yeah, no, I believe it's a plush keychain, so you can attach it to your keys. So it's probably, I don't know how big it is, but I mean, it depends where you keep your keys. I don't think it would fit in a pocket, but it might fit in a bag. But yeah, no, I mean, A24 shop are on a roll at the moment with the more quirky side of their marketing and the products. I mean, the bear in the cage was a phenomenon, and you know, initially sold out, but then they took it off sale because apparently the bots were buying them to put up on eBay for like about $500. So I missed out on one, sadly, but I did get my first reformed cap. It did come through in the post very quickly, I have to say. So well done. Thank you, A24 shop. And it looks fantastic. It makes it look like I'm a bit of a Jesus freak and a Bible basher. But, you know, for the people who understand the reference, I'm sure that it will give me extra geek credit points, I think. Part of the A24 hive. Actually, I was listening to an interview recently. There was a film critic who did the Philip French memorial lecture at a film festival, and they were talking about how fandom has increased over the years and that people get very protective over certain franchises. And apparently she'd reviewed Midsommar and given it a 2-star review, and this person had come after her, to the point where she said that the A24 hive are now worse than the Marvel clan. And I thought, wow. So what do you make of that? Do you think that the A24 crowd, because I think we're probably part of the A24 hive these days, aren't we? Are we as bad and as protective as, say, like the Nolan clan or the Marvel clan when it comes to, you know, criticism of the product?
Oh god, no, because I think for us that, and I think it can be proven in sort of here we are at 25 episodes in, and we've probably found that there's as much movies we've loved and enjoyed as there's been ones where it's like, oh, that wasn't that great, or we're maybe a bit confused at why this one was part of the filmography. And I think we've both got Letterboxd lists which sort of rank the movies as we go, and I think I've got maybe 4 or 5, you know, out of the sort of 50 odd movies we've maybe hit around this point or something, that I probably have given quite a low ranking to. So, you know, quite a few 1-stars in there, a couple of 2-stars, some movies which are just like, yeah. And I think that's the way it goes, that, you know, at the end of the day, they're a film distribution company. They will pick some good movies, some ones that will divide opinion in a positive way, some where people will maybe come away and go, what the hell was that? You know, you can't win all the time, and, you know, people are entitled to all their opinions. I have no bother at all if someone dislikes something, and I'm always happy to engage with someone on that, but I would never sort of discount someone's opinion.
Absolutely. I think we've been very fair and honest in our reviews of everything so far. Although Under the Silver Lake, I think we will still push it. To people who haven't seen it, you know, I can understand why some people wouldn't like Under the Silver Lake. It's certainly not for everyone. But the fact that it didn't get a huge release in the US and is very unseen, people are sort of slagging it off sight unseen. I think it's one that people need to seek out and sort of give their own opinion on. And speaking of sort of the farewell success at the box office versus Under the Silver Lake's failure at the box office. There was an interesting report, I think it maybe came from Reddit or somewhere, and this was sort of looking at the A24 home video deal. Now, I think some people, I know we've certainly experienced this ourselves, where certain films are quite difficult to track down, certainly in terms of physical media. Sometimes, you know, by using the iTunes account, stuff like that, we can find them online, but actually getting physical copies of them is sometimes quite difficult. And it turns out that there is basically, A24 have got a formula to their theatrical releases, which decides on what type of rollout they get on physical media. And essentially, that if an A24 film gets a theatrical release and it makes over $1 million at the US box office, it will get the full platform of DVD, Blu-ray, and digital release. An A24 film that does not cross the $1 million domestic gross mark will get a DVD release and a digital release. And this goes for any film, 24 films in the US that are done with partnerships. Now, Lionsgate, I believe this is probably more for the UK side of it. Lionsgate do release quite a lot of them. But they do see the film, A24 films, as still having a Blu-ray release in the UK, and they will push for physical copies wherever they can. And, for example, we've got a few issues here. Apparently, The Souvenir in America has already made $928,000, so it looks like it should get a Blu-ray release. Climax managed to get up to about the 800,000 mark, so it will probably only get a DVD. But then you get something like Under the Silver Lake, which has apparently only grossed 46,000 in the US, which just seems crazy. It's probably made more than that in the UK with limited screenings in the Glasgow Film Festival and the Prince Charles. So what do you think of this plan for the sort of physical media release rollout? Is it still important to provide a physical media release, or do you think that it's going to be, the future is digital?
I think the future will eventually be digital, but I think you should always give people the choice. And I think, you know, I think you nailed it. There's so many movies that we've perhaps struggled to get our hands on a physical copy to be able to watch, and we've had to rely on renting from Amazon Prime or, you know, creating iTunes USA accounts. You know, it's been quite good recently because when Midsommar dropped in America, the iTunes store in the US, I think there's about 37 A24 films, they did reduce to like 99 cents rentals, and I just blitzed a whole load of films that I'd maybe not seen, wanted to revisit, give a shot to again. And you know, the difficulty is, like, you have something like, as you say, Under the Silver Lake, which does not qualify for a Blu-ray release in America, but, you know, you can import it from France, and then it's going to come out here. Mubi are releasing the DVD and Blu-ray in the, I think, later in the year or something like that, so people will have to import it from the UK. So people will find ways to get these films, but when you have great films, you just are naturally making it more difficult for people. You know, Climax is going to be, as you say, a DVD in America, but we've had it on Blu-ray here for ages through Arrow, and they're sort of a boutique company that puts the effort into the artwork. You get a little booklet inside, you know, probably similar to the Criterion Collection to an extent. So people will have to find ways to increase their collection to Blu-ray and so on, if that's the way they want to go. I'm sure it'll get more complicated when it goes to 4K, but for me at the moment, I'm sort of sticking to digital when it comes to A24 films for renting. But there's certain ones that if I see it as sort of a reduced price, you know, I'll maybe pick it up on Blu-ray. Under the Silver Lake, I got on import from France like 2 days after I saw it at the cinema. I had been out for a while there as well, so, you know, my collection is a bit sporadic, but at least I know I can rent them kind of with ease.
Absolutely. So if anyone is looking to get Lee a birthday present or Christmas present, you can know that iTunes in US dollars gift card would always be appreciated. But I mean, I know what you mean. It's difficult sometimes. You know, we've got Netflix, you've got Amazon Prime, you've got so many different streaming services. I believe in the US, I think we talked about this on an earlier episode, that A24 seemed to partner with the US Library Service, where basically if you were a library member, you could get access to all their back catalogue for free, which is an amazing deal. I mean, I work at a library here in the UK, so a lot of the films are available on DVD there, so I do take them out from the library. I'm always going to be an advocate for a physical media collection, because the rights can change and pass over, and sometimes things will come off of catalogues. I know that the famed Ultraviolet sort of passcode series where you used to get like a film on it, you know, you'd buy a Universal Blu-ray and you'd get a little code inside saying you can watch it on streaming for free. But apparently that system is now going under, I think it just at the beginning of August. So, you know, if you ever had any films on that, I think they're going to disappear. So there's always that worry in my head that even though you've apparently bought something on digital, it could disappear at any moment. It's always like to have a physical collection. But yeah, I've pre-ordered my Mubi version of Under the Silver Lake, so I'm looking forward to getting that in late August. And finally, I'm also going to get Suspiria at the end of October. But, you know, all the Mubi had to do was last year when Suspiria came out was say, we're working on a DVD deal, and then that would have stopped people, you know, maybe, well, they still would have had to wait a year to get it, but, you know, it would have stopped them going on overseas to get an import and stuff, because I think you had to get one from Germany, wasn't it, for that?
Yeah, I got mine from Germany, but I knew many a person that got it all the way from Australia because of subtitles.
Yeah, I know, that's the only thing, because, yeah, you buy, I remember buying Snowpiercer on Blu-ray from France, and I ended up basically, it was French subtitles. It did have in English, but then with French subtitles. So then the scenes that were in Korean were in French subtitles, and it didn't have any English subtitles, so I had no idea what they were talking about. So I then ended up having to get a US DVD as well. Then, of course, 4 or 5 years later, it finally comes up on Netflix. So you never know, but there are options out there. But, you know, if anyone, if you're struggling to find a certain A24 film that you want to watch, you know, just drop us a message on Twitter, and I'm sure we'll be able to help you out and point you out in the right direction of where you want to go. So, for example, if you want to see one of today's releases, and the first one is Supersonic, and that is directed by Matt Whitecross, and is an in-depth look at the life and music of Manchester-based rock band Oasis, specifically from the creation of the band up until their record-breaking gigs at Nebworth in 1997. Now, this film has an 83% rating on Rotten Tomatoes for the critics, and 87% with the audience, and was the winner of the Best Documentary at the Empire Awards 2017. So, Lee, what was your first introduction to this film? And I guess the bigger question is, were you an Oasis fan?
I was a Blur fan, and that was sort of like, when I was a young kid, I sort of was obsessed with like watching movies and TV, especially Star Trek. And I would always kind of, if I wanted an album, it would always be like, I wanted the Star Trek The Next Generation soundtrack on tape or something like that. And I remembered one Christmas that I got given the Blur, The Great Escape album. I must have been maybe 7, 8 or something at the time. That was probably considered my first proper album. And sort of Blur were naturally the band I would sort of gravitate towards. Like I liked Oasis, there was a lot of their songs I liked, but I was always more of a Blur kid. And you know, I always thought with Blur was that I enjoyed the music and I didn't really ever need to know much about Damon Albarn and the rest of the band. Where sort of Oasis, they were the music, but they were also this like cult of personality that, you know, they had these fans as well, which I kind of found quite annoying sometimes. You'd see them, they were sort of the bucket hat wearers, the people throwing the pints at gigs and stuff like that. And I just can't be doing with that sort of patter at all. So I was naturally more a Blur fan, but I was always sort of interested in Blur. I found sort of Noel Gallagher quite an interesting character. And yeah, it was one of those ones that I'd never sort of got round to watching the film because I felt like I don't really care that much. I felt like I knew the whole story behind those guys anyway, how they got signed, sort of their personalities, what went on there, the sort of feuding, whether it was a work or a shoot half the time. So I never felt sort of the need to watch the film. And with this podcast, I was like, oh, this is a film I'll get around to eventually. And I got it in the 99-cent sale a couple of weeks ago when Midsommar came out. And yeah, I really liked this film. It was what I liked was that it didn't add anything overly new that I didn't already know before. But I liked sort of how it painted some of the stories of what it was like to be this band on the road, have all this opportunity for drink, drugs and excess, and things like them getting up into antics on an Amsterdam like ferry, etc. And I just enjoyed listening to those stories, and I thought it was a perfectly inconsequential documentary. I'm not necessarily sure why A24 picked this one up, because I always think like they're mostly probably thinking about American audiences. I don't know how American audiences are necessarily going to react or have much interest in Oasis, but I thought it was definitely well worth watching. I think when you look at the team involved, I think it's had the same producer. The producer was the director of Amy and Maradona, which are two of my favorite documentaries of the past few years when it comes to personalities and talents. So this one, it doesn't come close to matching those films, but it's quite an enjoyable way to spend a Sunday evening, and that's how I watched it. What about for yourself?
Well, you know, I mean, I was an Oasis fan back in the day, I think more than Blur. I think definitely maybe it was probably the first album I bought on CD with my pocket money and stuff like that. I would have been 14 when Definitely Maybe came out, so I was probably just at the right sort of age for that sort of thing. I remember that basically at my school there would be, you'd have like the Oasis and sort of Blur sort of fans on one side of the sort of common room and stuff like that, and then like Stone Roses and stuff on the other side. I mean, Stone Roses were basically the precursor for Oasis back then, so you'd have all these sort of little rivalries at school depending on which music you sort of listened to, and I think Oasis were huge. I was one of the few people who didn't actually go to the gig when Oasis played Aberdeen Exhibition and Conference Centre in 1990, I think it was 96 or 97, and felt like I was missing out by not being there. Everyone else seemed to be there, and this was back in the day when you had to queue up physically to get tickets for concerts and stuff like that. I can't remember why I didn't go or didn't get a ticket. Maybe it was just my parents wouldn't let me, I don't know, but I was clearly still not bitter about it. But I mean, I enjoyed it. I mean, I think like what you're saying is, yeah, there was a certain sort of culture around sort of Oasis at the time with being the sort of the bad boys of rock and roll at this time, you know, sort of swearing, getting drunk, being leery and stuff like that, almost emulating sort of their heroes of the past with like The Who and stuff like that. Just wanting to, yeah, I mean, that Amsterdam ferry story is something else that basically they caused so much havoc on the thing that they basically didn't get into Amsterdam. They were basically sent right back. And this was at the point where you had the sort of the generation of Britpop, you know. This was just around about the time that Trainspotting was coming out, and it was all your sort of FHMs and sort of Nuts and sort of Lad Mags and stuff like this. And there was this culture around that was being created. And, you know, part of me would have almost maybe liked to have seen more of a look at that side of things, or maybe even a bit more of the sort of rivalry between Blur and Oasis. Because, I mean, I remember that famous thing, which was clearly done purely for the media and for generating press, was having Oasis and Blur release a CD single in the same week in a race to number one. You know, you don't really get that kind of thing anymore. That was a huge deal back then. Do you remember when Country House faced off against Roll With It for the number one slot?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I remember, and it's one of those things, like, it's completely changed the charts these days. I know what it was like for myself, that you would listen to sort of the top 40, that there was always the debate who's going to be number one. It wasn't just like Christmas number one, but would this band be this week? And, you know, sitting by the like the radio and hitting that tape button record for kind of getting some of the tracks on. I definitely think it's definitely changed so quickly how people kind of think about music charts. I think even sort of to get to number one these days, you barely need any sort of traction to get there. It's, you know, when you think of sort of like Oasis and Blur dueling it out, you know, they were looking at tens of thousands upon thousands to get to that number one. Nowadays, you could probably get by with a couple thousand downloads.
Yeah, it's a couple thousand under streaming. It's like, you know, when I think is it Drake that now holds the record for number of weeks at number one, and that's basically due to streaming. When, you know, there was a huge thing of is it like Wet 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 and Bryan Adams, you know, being number one for like 11-13 weeks, and it's like, is he going to be number one again? Let's find out. And you're waiting for the radio DJ to press play on the record, and it's like, he's done it again. It's like, people, you know, back then it was like, I guess it's kind of similar to like these days with the Avatar box office record. Nobody really thought that was ever going to go until Avengers Endgame slowly kept re-releasing and re-releasing until it managed to eventually get over the line. Until James Cameron, of course, re-releases Avatar in the run-up to his sequels and then becomes number one again. But yeah, the charts were a much bigger deal back then. And yeah, I like you, I remember sort of saying by now, kids who are listening to this podcast, you know, if you wanted a song and to have it to listen to again and again, you had to record it off the radio with a cassette tape. And basically you would try and stop it before the DJ would then start speaking over it and ruin the tape. You know, this is the troubles that we had to go to. You know, these days you just put it on YouTube or Spotify. You know, it was a big deal trying to get a song off the radio. People don't understand the struggles we used to go through, I don't think. But, I mean, like you say, this is produced by sort of the Afis Kabada, who did Senna, Amy, and the excellent Diego Maradona film, which I can highly recommend for this year. And you can see his influence in it because it does have a very sort of similar sort of structure to it, in that it's not a talking head documentary. It's all done with archive footage, with the sort of interviews and stuff laced on top of it. So it feels very similar to it. And it's probably because of the fact that you'd never be able to get sort of Noel and Liam in the same room these days to talk about their feelings towards each other and stuff like that. So I can understand why they've sort of done it. And, you know, you've got this sort of famous sort of story of how they broke into the business, where they sort of ended up driving up to Glasgow with another band, and then Alan McGee from Creation Records happened to be at the gig and then sort of signed them on the spot. He's like, after one song, he was like, "Oh, I might give them a record deal." And then after the second song, he's like, "I'm definitely giving them a record deal." And then like third song, he basically is like, "I'm going to give them a multiple record deal," because he thought they were that good. And, you know, so this documentary follows them across sort of like the first sort of 3 years of their career, where they sort of tour around the world. You sort of get Definitely Maybe, you get What's the Story, Morning Glory, and then sort of heading into these, I think, still record-breaking gigs at Nebworth, where I was looking up an article in the BBC today about it. They had one from a couple of years ago about it, and apparently 2.5 million people applied for tickets, and so that was apparently 4% of the population at that time applied to see Oasis at Nebworth, and 250,000 people watched them over the course of 2 nights. And these were like the biggest gigs that the UK had seen at that point. You know, just that number of people who would normally go to a festival purely for one band. I mean, they were the biggest band in the UK at that time. And it wasn't probably just the music, it was the whole sort of cult of personality around them, with the sort of the rock and roll lifestyle and stuff like that. And I mean, I remember them being the hugest thing. And I remember, I think, queuing up at midnight outside HMV on Union Street to get the Be Here Now album, which was not as good as the first two, but still have a couple of really good songs on it. But, you know, it was interesting that at the end of the documentary, it's sort of them admitting that, I think, Noel and maybe Bonehead sort of say that they should have called it quits then and there. They were never going to be able to surpass that moment. And so, I mean, what do you think? I mean, looking at Oasis sort of in the years since, do you think that that was their crowning achievement, those gigs? And should they have called it a day then? You know, it's better to burn out than to fade away. Should they have sort of called it quits at that point?
Yeah, I don't think their music was ever particularly that great afterwards. I think I quite enjoyed the Standing on Shoulders of Giants album. I can't quite remember. I think I always remembered when they sort of changed their logo from the traditional sort of the white font with the black background to something like a more kind of modern design. I thought, yeah, they've kind of lost it for me. They've never sort of, I could barely kind of think of any sort of bangers or great hits that they've had sort of since that sort of heyday, and I think that would have been the way to go on. I don't think it's ever properly affected their reputation in any way, that it was so good and so strong in those 90s days that they could have fucking done Mr. Blobby or something like that and no one would have batted an eyelid or reconsidered them. So I think, yeah, they've continued on, and they seem to be doing quite well with their sort of solo acts these days. So yeah, and there seems to still be the odd story about the Gallagher brothers kind of feuding as well in the press. So, you know, what is it, the more things change, the more they sort of stay the same.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, the moment it's like Noel Gallagher's feuding with Lewis Capaldi, who I still don't really know who this guy is and what the big deal about him is, but, you know, he seems to be everywhere at the moment in the UK. And, you know, I mean, they've still got enough cultural cachet in the UK that, you know, when England won this epic, what was it, cricket final on the last ball or something, they still managed to, they used a champagne supernova reference on all the papers and stuff like that. So people still know the music, still play the music. You know, if anyone, you know, strikes up Wonderwall, you know, you're going to get people singing along, you know. And also there was that wonderful moment in Yesterday, which wasn't for everyone, but there was a bit about the fact that the Beatles, you know, no one remembers the Beatles except for one guy, and he's sort of Googling the Beatles and stuff like that, and he's Googling other musical references. They still exist, but when he gets to Oasis, they never formed. And he's like, well, makes sense, because, yeah, they were such huge fans of the Beatles that it makes sense. But I think For this, I think, yeah, it seems like a rather safe documentary in that the time period that it looks at is very much of them at their heyday. I might have liked to have seen a documentary looking at the breakup of the band. I think that's where the real juicy gossip is and stuff like that, but maybe they just weren't willing to talk about it. And I think it's the kind of thing where it's an exciting period of to see them on the crest of the wave, but I think there was more stuff to follow afterwards. But I think in terms of, like you say, a nice, safe, enjoyable documentary, it's very good. But I think there is better films about Oasis out there to be made in the future. I think if you want a really great documentary about a music act with warring brothers in it, I think everyone should watch the Bross documentary, which came out earlier this year, which is just a work of genius, which seemed like a spoof, but actually turned out to be actually completely true. And they just didn't realize that they were so self-aware, I think.
Yeah, that's a hell of a music documentary. You know, they can be varying in quality, but that one is definitely one of the top tier ones.
Yeah, so I mean, where does this one sort of rank for you? Is this a chart-topping hit, or is this one that's likely to sort of fall out of the top 40 quite quickly?
Yeah, this is sort of a middle of the road A24 film for me, though I'm happy if they send me candles and pins and whatever like that. I'm happy to give them positive reviews for everything and be that hive mind. But yeah, this is sort of a middle of the road A24 film. I still don't understand necessarily why they bought this one. I don't know. I don't get the impression that Oasis are that huge really in America, to be honest. Sort of they were maybe all right at the time, but I don't think they have kind of a cultural impact there. And yeah, it was a good, as I mentioned earlier, it was a good Sunday afternoon film to watch, and that's sometimes all I need. It was watched it, plenty of laughs, some good stories, yeah, good enough, kind of move on sort of thing. So yeah, a good entry.
Yeah, no, I think it's a good documentary about a good band. But I think if you're a hardcore Oasis fan and you're looking for something to find something new about the band, I don't think you're going to find it here, but you're going to get a good trip sort of down memory lane, I think, with this one. So moving on, our next film on this episode is The Monster, and this is written and directed by Brian Bertino, who was behind the horror film The Strangers, and it stars Zoe Kazan and Ella Ballantyne, and it's about a mother and daughter who must confront a terrifying monster when they break down on a deserted road. And this currently holds an 8% critic rating on Rotten Tomatoes and 40% on the audience rating. So quite a split difference of opinion there. Lee, how did you first hear about this film, and when did you first see it, and what did you think of it?
This one has been on my watch list for quite a while. So when we started this project, I sort of looked out, know that one, I've heard of that one, looking forward to this one. Oh, I'm desperate to check that one out. You know, as I sort of mentioned with the Oasis Supersonic one, it was like a film I was aware of, but had no reason or excuse to kind of check out. With kind of this one, I'd heard of it in terms of the title alone, and the closer and closer I got, I still didn't know too much about this film, and then it eventually was on sort of my watch list to finally check it out. And yeah, I picked this one up in the 99 cents sale as well, and yeah, it was fine. I think it has some interesting ideas. I think Zoe Kazan is definitely played against type here, which is really exciting. I think she's a really exciting acting talent, and you know, she's always been sort of a really nice person in films, you know, as an interesting roles like that. But to see her in this as sort of a drug and alcohol dependent bad mother and sort of go through that redemption arc was really interesting, to see Zoe Kazan take on that role. And it took a little bit of settling in for me to sort of accept it as, that's Zoe Kazan. I always think of her as quite a sensitive kind of character, someone that seems very vulnerable and, you know, kind of somewhat adorable to an extent. So it was kind of weird to try and see her in this type of role, but I kind of settled into it and enjoyed it. It, you know, I've barely remembered a thing about it afterwards, and I do feel it drags on a little too long. It's, you know, the film is all pretty much based within sort of this car and then sort of an ambulance vehicle all within one street of a road, and that time, that the length of the film sort of drags, even if with the kind of the odd flashback here and there. It was a fine enough film, but one that didn't sort of do much for me.
Yeah, and I mean, Zoe Kazan is definitely playing against type. I mean, most people probably sort of know her from maybe films like sort of Ruby Sparks and What If, where she is sort of playing the sort of manic sort of pixie girl, and I did like that she was cast against type in this as, like you say, an alcoholic and drug using mother who's not really ever been there for her daughter, but has to come through in the clutch when they're attacked by this monster. And I think I'm looking at the IMDb trivia, apparently she maybe replaced Elizabeth Moss, was originally cast in this film, so she actually replaced her. So that's something that it seems more of a natural fit for someone like Elizabeth Moss. But I did like that they went against type with that. I mean, I didn't know much about it yourself. It was a film which I don't think really had a UK cinema release here. I think it was like a straight-to-DVD one here, but is now currently on Netflix in the UK if you want to watch this one. And I had high hopes when I heard that it was by the Brian Bertino who did The Strangers, horror film from a few years ago that starred Liv Tyler, a sort of really good home invasion horror film. It plays it very straight and quite nasty, and I did like that. But I think I did have a problem with this film in that it seemed very heavy-handed in its sort of metaphors and allegories towards sort of the monster. And it's like this girl is dealing with an abusive alcoholic mother, and it's like, is she the monster? It's like she battling her own demons, and it's like, does the daughter have to cut the mother and the monster out of her life in order to survive? And then it's like, does the mother have to battle her demons both internally and physically externally to do it? And I did what, because I was wondering for a while, it's like, is the monster even real, or is it in the head of like the daughter, and it's just the mother who's, you know, doing all these things? And that wasn't really made so entirely clear for me. I did wonder sort of back and forth, but I felt it was maybe a bit too heavy-handed in that. Did you sort of get a sense of that, or was that just my interpretation reading into the film?
I think I was that sort of, I'm kind of watching this film and going with it, that I took it all at incredibly face value. And I'm not saying that what you're saying isn't true, it's just my viewing experience was so kind of boring, and just sort of, it was on and I was just sort of like just letting it kind of wash over me, that I never sort of engaged with it on any sort of level that made me think, could this be happening, is this all in her head, you know? And that's maybe just the film just didn't grip me, I think.
Yeah, no, I mean, you said that you thought it sort of went on a bit too long. Now, this is a film which is only 91 minutes. So, I mean, sometimes that is a way with certain movies. You know, you get a film like this, which seems to drag on far too long. It's only 90 minutes. Or you can get a film like Blade Runner 2049 or Midsommar, which are sort of 2.5-3 hours long, but it never feels like that. It's all down to the execution and the editing and stuff like that. And I think it did seem quite repetitive, and then once the sort of car breaks down in the middle of nowhere, it's like someone comes along to help them, the monster attacks, it kills that person, and then they're left alone, and then someone else comes along to help them, and then they get attacked, and then they have to keep it felt quite repetitive in its method and stuff like that. And I mean, the monster was apparently designed by sort of Gillis and Woodruff Jr., who have done the monster designs for things like Alien and stuff like that. And it seemed odd that when you have people like that designing a monster, that you never really see it in full. It seemed to always be in the shadow, and it's like they weren't really sure what sort of the design was, because it almost seemed to me like this monster didn't actually have any legs or something. It was kind of just sort of skulking around. It had like the head and the teeth and the mouth out of, it looked reminiscent of one of the monsters from The Relic, which is a terrible film from the mid-90s, but they never seemed to be that keen to show it. Maybe they're trying to go for like a Jaws sort of thing, where the less you see, it's more effective. But I thought with something like that, you kind of needed to see and sort of understand the dimensions of the monster to try and figure out how dangerous it really was. What did you think of the monster's design?
Yeah, it reminded me of the alien creatures from Attack the Block. And I thought they were interesting sort of creature features, but it was one of those ones, it felt like something I'd seen kind of plenty of times before and just didn't kind of lack an impact. This sort of like dark creature where you see sort of the teeth, and I was like, oh, this kind of put me in the mood for Attack the Block more than sort of this film. And you know, it's, I suppose there's only so much things that you can do with some creatures sometimes, but this one just didn't strike me as the most inventive or original or memorable one. And as you were kind of saying, a lot of the film is so repetitive that, you know, at that 90 minutes, that seeing this sort of creature just do the same things, the same kind of kills, etc., it never takes the film to sort of anywhere new or exciting, and there's nothing about this creature that grips you or that you learn more about as the sort of film goes on. And yeah, it was just not the most memorable one in the world. What about for yourself?
Yeah, no, I think, like you say, I think you've sort of hit the nail on the head with this one, with the fact that it wasn't really, the creature wasn't that memorable, inventive or original. And I think that's the problem with the film as well. And that, you know, with A24 films, you are often expecting them to sort of push the boundaries of filmmaking and give us incredibly original pieces of authorship, you know, like American Honey and Moonlight that we discussed last week. And then you've got something here which feels very cookie cutter and generic in terms of its horror staples and stuff like that. And you know, sometimes films like that, if they're executed incredibly well, can break out and become a hit. You know, like, you know, we mentioned the film It Follows earlier. You know, it touches upon very many other films, such as the work of John Carpenter and stuff like that, yet it does it in such a way that it puts a new twist on it. And it sort of breaks out of that genre again. Under the Silver Lake, you know, does a lot of film noir stuff, but does it in a new way. It's just the David Robert Mitchell's voice of finding a new spin to put on the material. And I think that's what's lacking here. It's like they're telling a story which has been done before. And although the performances are very good, Zoe Kazan is great. And the young girl, Ella Ballantyne, is very good as well as the daughter, dealing with the trauma that she's gone through. But I think the performances are great, but the everything wrapped around it is not strong enough to really sort of merit its place on in the great pantheon of A24 films. Would you agree?
Yeah, it's sort of lower tier for me. So yeah, I think, again, people will start to just think that we're sort of throwing this film under the ambulance in this case, because we want to prove that we're not part of the A24 hive mind and that we can be critical. But yeah, not one I'll probably ever revisit, to be honest.
No, I don't think so. I mean, like you say, I mean, if you're watching these films along with us, you know, it's everyone's got different opinions. People will like things that we don't like, so we always encourage you to watch all the films and come back with your own opinion. But if you do want to talk to us about any of the films, you can always get us on Twitter. So Lee, where can people find you to discuss the merits of The Monster?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Lee_Nostromo. And for those that are A24 fans, one would assume that you have seen or liked or have opinions on Midsommar and Hereditary on our other podcast, Filibuster. We're about to just physically record an episode, so it's going to be available by the time you hear this, about Ari Aster's short movie. So definitely check that one out, and maybe we'll find out why A24 took a chance on this first-time director.
Absolutely, and you can catch me on Twitter at champcelluloid. But we're going to be back, we'll be back in 2 weeks' time to review 20th Century Women and Trespass Against Us. But of course, as Lee's already mentioned, for every other week you'll be able to catch a brand new interview. So next week you'll be able to get Disaster Piece, as Lee and him talk about the scores for It Follows and Under the Silver Lake and his career in also so talking about video game music as well. So that's well worth a listen to. But in the meantime, we'll catch you then. But as always, if you want to leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, it'll be very much appreciated and you'll get a mention on the next show. So until next time, we'll see you later. Bye-bye.